Online in high definition sound. It's 1 o'clock, time for the news now, read by David Cornett.
As Labour's annual conference gets underway in Manchester, Ed Miliband has announced that he would be prepared to legislate to split the retail and investment functions of banks to prevent a repeat of the financial crisis. Mr Miliband also insisted that he wouldn't let the party give in to sectional interests, and that while he valued Labour's links with the trades unions, he wouldn't allow them to determine his policy on public sector pay. The number of American service personnel killed in the conflict in Afghanistan has reached 2,000. A US soldier was among several people shot dead in the east of the country in what appears to be another insider attack by a member of the Afghan security forces. Iraqi police say 23 people have been killed and more than 50 have been wounded in a series of car bombings. The attacks took place in and around Baghdad, as well as in the northern city of Mosul and the southern city of Kut. A grenade attack on a Sunday school in the Kenyan capital Nairobi has killed one child and critically injured several others. A police spokesman said that many of the victims were injured in a stampede as people tried to flee the church. The Church of England says that the final selection of a successor to Rowan Williams as Archbishop of Canterbury may not take place for several weeks or even months. Following the speculation that the selection panel has failed to agree on a candidate, officials have stressed that the process could go on throughout the autumn. Dr. Williams steps down at the end of the year. Golf, the final day of play in the Ryder Cup, gets underway in a few hours in Chicago, with the Americans just 4.5 points short of victory. Europe will have to equal the biggest comeback in the history of the contest if they're to retain the trophy. And the weather, sunny spells and scattered blustery showers for Scotland and Northern Ireland, occasional heavy rain moving south through northern England, Wales and the Midlands, while southeastern England should stay dry. BBC News and Weather at 1:02.
And it was read by David Cornett. It's time now on Radio 3 to join Lucy Skeeping for today's Early Music Show.
Welcome to the show. I wonder whether you know the music of Henri Dumont. He and his colleague Pierre Robert were both assistant masters of music, or sous-maîtres, of the Chapel Royal under King Louis XIV of France. They held their post throughout much of the 1660s and 70s, finally leaving after some 20 years in the job working alongside each other. That's quite an impressive tenure of office when you consider Louis XIV's sometimes difficult and highly temperamental master of music, Jean-Baptiste Lully, not to mention the forceful and opinionated personality of the king himself. By the time they retired from the chapel, Dumont, the most prolific of the two, was in his 70s and Robert well into his 60s, and the French court was about to undergo the major upheaval of moving from Paris to its new base at Versailles. It seemed a good time then to hand in the towel, but the process of choosing their successors was to prove dramatic and contentious. In fact, as we'll hear over the next hour, a competition was held, a sort of Baroque X Factor with a bit of politics thrown in. But before we get into all that, let's have a listen to the kind of music that Dumont was composing. Most of it liturgical, of course. Both he and Robert made quite a name for themselves by pioneering what became known as the Grand Motet, large-scale works for double choir and orchestra. But Dumont also introduced the royal court to smaller or petit motets, like this one from his first collection. And how nice to hear it in this recording with real boys' voices. O Panis Angelorum.
Oh.
the motet O Panis Angelorum by Henri Dumont, long-serving sous-maître of Louis XIV's Chapel Royal. The performers were Les Pages and Chantreux de la Chapelle, directed by Olivier Schneebly. So the decision was made in the early 1680s for the French court to move its headquarters out of Paris to Versailles. It was all change time for pretty much everything and everyone, including the people running the royal chapel. And it was decided that not two, but four new composers needed to be appointed as sous-maître this time, a sort of long-term job share, with each of them placed in charge of the music for a defined season of the year. An appointment at the Chapel Royal was obviously a plum job. Lots of composers applied, and I guess all of them would have been very conscious that perhaps their greatest challenge, maybe even more than the music, would be above all to please the very demanding Lully, the king's right-hand musical maestro, and you could say the Simon Cowell of our story. Indeed, Lully would undoubtedly have had the final say on who the winner was going to be. He'd been close to the king since they were both youngsters, when he began working in the household of the king's niece and found himself dancing in a court ballet opposite the 14-year-old king. His rise through the ranks was extraordinary, and he eventually enjoyed an extremely high degree of power in the royal circle. As a composer, Lully was more associated with opera-style stage performances, particularly compositions that were usually packed with flattering allegories about his boss, the Sun King. But he famously had a finger in every musical pie at court, including writing for the Chapel Royal himself. So anyone applying for the job there would have been well aware of the standards he required. This is part of his Miserere Mei Deus, the opening symphonia. It was first given in 1664, just a year after Dumont and Robert had first been appointed, so perhaps knowing Lully's character, it was written as some kind of challenge to the newcomers.
Thank you.
the opening to Lully's Miserere Me Deus, performed by Le Concert Spirituel, directed by Hervé Niquet. The 1683 competition to become one of the four musical supremos at the Chapel Royal in Versailles was advertised in the recently founded Mercure Galant, a magazine that informed elegant society about fashion, art, etiquette and life at court. Any post in the court of Louis XIV would, of course, have been much coveted, and some 35 composers applied for the four jobs on offer. A good half of them were eliminated after the first round, but among the applicants were some of the most famous names of the period, including Marc-Antoine Charpentier. We're going to hear Charpentier's really gorgeous funeral mass, Messe pour les Trépassés. We don't know who the deceased was in this case, but since the manuscript survives in a collection alongside some of Charpentier's music for Holy Week, it could be that it was performed at a service that took place around that time of the year. Lamb of God, that takest away the sins of the world, give them everlasting rest. part of the Messe pour les Trépassés, a funeral mass by Marc-Antoine Charpentier, performed there by Les Arts Florissants, directed by William Christie. You'd have thought, wouldn't you, that anyone who could compose a mass of that quality would have been appointed instantly to one of the four vacant posts at the French Chapel Royal. But in the event, we're told that Charpentier retired from the contest, apparently because of illness. So, just how were the appointments finally made? Well, not as we might run competitions today, that's for sure, with the judges quietly reading over the collections of manuscripts submitted by the candidates. No, it was all far more theatrical than that. It was decided to hold a competition in which those on the final shortlist were asked to compose a new grand motet based on the text of Psalm 31. The applicants were all locked up in separate rooms, we're told, to make sure there was no cheating. Then the resulting motets were performed before the court, and eventually the four winners were announced. And they were, although not in any specific order. Firstly, Nicolas Goupier. But oh dear, it seems that perhaps they should have appointed a younger applicant instead of him, the talented but unstable Henri Desmarais, because some time after Goupier was safely ensconced in his new post, it was discovered that he was secretly paying Desmarais to write pieces for him and passing them off as his own. In fact, Goupier seems to have been quite a suspicious character generally, because he also falsified his CV on the competition application, claiming to have been a pupil at Notre Dame of one of the previous Chapel Royal sous-maîtres, Pierre Robert, although there's no record of him ever having been enrolled there. Maybe the competition judges didn't find out about all this, or maybe they just didn't care too much about corruption, because, as we've heard, Goupier was indeed one of the four winners. As for the other three, they were Pascal Collas and Guillaume Minerey, both of whose music we're going to hear later, and one whose name may just be a little more familiar these days, Michel Richard de la Londe. And this, ladies and gentlemen, is part of de la Londe's winning composition, and in fact the only one of the actual entry pieces to survive, his setting of Psalm 31. Beati quorum remisse sunt. Blessed is he whose iniquities are forgiven.
Thank you. Tribulationi che circondit me, exultatio mea, exultatio mea, virgo mea circondatibus me.
Flash
Soloists Salome Haller, Damien Guillon, Howard Crook, Hervé Lamy, Alain Bouet, and Les Pages and Les Chantres de Versailles, together with La Grande Écurie and La Chambre du Roi, were directed by Olivier Schneebly there, in part of de Lalande's setting of Psalm 31. You're listening to the Early Music Show with me, Lucy Skeeping, and today I'm exploring the competition held at the court of Louis XIV to find him four new sous-maîtres for his chapel royal. There's no doubt about de Lalande's talent as a composer, but the fact was that several of those who didn't make it into the competition were also highly gifted, such as the Italian-born Paolo Lorenzani, who would surely have been a fine addition to the Royal Chapel. He had been, on King Louis's own recommendation, Master of Music to the Queen, so he was already well known and admired in the royal circle. This is Le Concert Spirituel, directed by Hervé Niquet, with Lorenzani's Motet for the Ascension. I, a sinner, fear to approach to the table of your sweetest banquet, merciful Lord Jesus Christ, for my body and heart are stained with many crimes.
Thank you.
Le Concert Spirituel, directed by Hervé Niquet, with a motet for the Ascension, a setting by Paolo Lorenzani, one of the composers working for the French court in the second half of the 17th century. Yet, in spite of such charming operatic-style lines, word painting and duetting, there would be no Lorenzani for the Chapel Royal. In fact, the announcement of the four winners seems to have caused something of a scandal, at least if you read the surprisingly independent-minded pages of the Mercure Galant. The publication held Lully responsible for the somewhat quirky result, no doubt rightly, and included some pretty strong stuff about the stranglehold he was generally exercising over music in France at the time. And to make things look even worse, one of the four composers who did win, Pascal Collas, had been Lully's assistant just before the Royal Chapel job competition came up. Mind you, Collas, too, was no mean composer, judging by this. It's one of his four spiritual canticles, an unusual sound, since although these are religious devotional texts, the style is very kind of chatty, not surprising, perhaps, since he wrote the song specifically for the nuns of Saint-Cyr in Paris. And as you'll hear, he took into account the lightness of the voices of the all-female singers. For these ladies, it was all about the words, the rediscovery of the ancient art of declamation and a vernacular personal connection with God. O Lord, what a cruel war. I find these two parts in me, one full of love for thee, the other disobedient to thy will.
Thank you.
The Plaints of a Christian on the Contradictions He Feels Within Himself, one of three church canticles in vernacular style by Pascal Collas, who was one of the successful applicants for the four posts of Sumetra at Louis XIV's Royal Chapel. Earlier, I mentioned one of the other winners, Nicolas Goupier, whose application, it must be said, was pretty dubious. Had he really been a young chorister at Notre Dame, as he claimed? But the big scandal that really caught up with Goupier later on was that he seems to have been actually paying another composer to write his motets for him, and that person was Henri Desmarais, who, ironically, was one of the unsuccessful candidates for the Sumetra posts. Desmarais, a mere lad of 22 at the time of the scam and obviously in need of the money, may not have won as himself then, but it is rather satisfying to hear that in the end he blew the whistle and exposed Goupier. And after all that fiasco, he certainly deserves 4 minutes of BBC airtime. Requiem Aeternum from Henri Desmarais' De Profundis, performed by Le Concert Spirituel, directed by Hervé Niquet. Musical contests are nothing new, I guess. History is full of them, although this one certainly seems to have been particularly suspect in various ways, with the manipulative presence of Lully hovering over the proceedings. The whole thing, as I say, was supremely political. Of the four successful candidates to be appointed Sumetra to the Chapel Royal, the evidence suggests that Goupier was the protégé of one of the outgoing Sumetras, Colas was backed by Lully, so he was bound to win. Minaret was said to have had the support of an archbishop. And the fourth, de Lalande, seems to have been chosen directly by the king. And of course, no one would have dared contradict his choice. Well, the four new assistant masters of the Chapel Royal in Versailles were duly appointed and each assigned his portion of the year. De Lalande, appropriately enough perhaps, was given the most important quarter, the period that included Christmas. But let's be fair to the others. Life was tough and good jobs were scarce. So let's end with music by another of the lucky winners, Guillaume Minaret, the Agnus Dei from his Christmas Mass.
The Agnus Dei from the Christmas Mass by Minaret. And it ends today's early music show. It was presented by Lucy Skeeping and produced in Salford by Sam Phillips. And from tomorrow morning, you can download a podcast version of that programme from the BBC Radio 3 website. Just follow the links to the early music show pages.
On BBC Two, Ian Hislop explores a very British characteristic.
For many Britons, the stiff upper lip remains a badge of national pride.
I always feel terribly uncomfortable when there are vast outpourings of emotion.
I'm going to explore what the British were like before their lips stiffened and how they became known for their stoicism, emotional restraint and determination.
Ian Hislop's Stiff Upper Lip, an emotional history of Britain, starts with the first episode of a three-part series this Tuesday night at 9 on BBC Two.
BBC Two television, that is. Well, there's a veritable plethora of pianists on Radio 3 tomorrow as part of the piano season on the BBC. Noriko Ogawa plays Debussy in the Radio 3 lunchtime concert at 1 o'clock. Sergio Tiempo is the soloist in Liszt's first piano concerto in Afternoon on 3. Angela Hewitt talks to Susie Klein on In Tune. Alexei Grignyuk gives a Chopin and Liszt recital in our live concert at 7:30. And Robert Mitchell gives a left-hand-only performance in Jazz on 3. And you can find out more about the season by going to the Radio 3 website. Tonight brings drama on 3. Simon Russell Beale's portrayal of Joseph Stalin was one of the highlights of the National Theatre's programme in 2011. And this evening, our drama on 3 brings you a new radio adaptation of this acclaimed production. In John Hodges' Olivier Award-winning play, Collaborators, The playwright Mikhail Bulgakov reluctantly accepts a commission to write a play celebrating Stalin's 60th birthday, and he gets more help than he'd imagined from Stalin himself. That's our Drama on Three at 8:30 tonight. Well, back to this afternoon, just gone 2 o'clock, time now for the Sunday Concert. It's presented by John Toll.
This concert marks the start of the new Ulster Orchestra season with music exhilarating, magical and dramatic from three Russian masters. A season that follows on the heels of the Titanic centenary and leads us into 2013 when Derry, Londonderry becomes UK City of Culture. And there's a great sense of anticipation in the Waterfront Hall in Belfast as in a few moments' time, principal conductor Joanne Folletta will be taken to the podium to begin her second season in post. At rehearsals earlier, she cast her eye over tonight's Russian Romance.
Well, John, this is the programme I think I've been looking forward to the most because it is music that is steeped in a romantic Russian tradition, which is a kind of large scale, very, very dramatic, beautifully singing repertoire from Borodin from his opera, Prince Igor, the dances, which are so well known, and a tour de force for the orchestra, through the Rachmaninoff Rhapsody on the theme of Paganini, his last piano work, and really for virtuoso pianist and Peter Donohoe, and also virtuoso orchestra. And then ending the piece that I find especially beautiful, Rimsky's Scheherazade.
Joanne Folletta. And the orchestra will be weaving the magical tale of Scheherazade in the second half. Before that, Peter Donohoe with one of the pinnacles of the piano repertoire, that Paganini Rhapsody by Rachmaninoff. So lots of colour and lots of beautiful, hummable melodies in store this afternoon. The Polovtsian Dances, which opens the concert, famously contains the tune that formed the basis of Tony Bennett's number one hit from 1955, Stranger in Paradise, from the musical Kismet. To describe the composer Borodin as multi-talented would do him an injustice. He spoke five languages, he played four instruments, he championed women's rights in Russia, and although we in this context remember his small but significant musical output, symphonies, operas, string quartets and songs, music was really his Sunday rest. His day job was also as a world-renowned organic chemist, and he became professor of the Academy in St. Petersburg. Although the Plotian Dances exists as a standalone piece, the music actually comes from Act 2 of Borodin's opera Prince Igor, who's defending his country against the Plotian hordes. And in Act 2, he's captured by them, but in a very civilised demonstration of the treatment of prisoners, they entertain the prisoner with dance. And now Joanne Folletta conducts the Ulster Orchestra in Borodin's Plotian Dances.
Thank you. Thank you.